Welcome to the Stem Cell Report. I'm Martin Pera, the editor-in-chief of Stem Cell Reports, the open access journal of the International Society for Stem Cell Research. Over the 10-year history of Stem Cell Reports, the journal has published nearly 2,000 papers and counting across the breadth of stem cell science. As the journal continues to celebrate a decade of publishing impactful science, this podcast will look at highlights from the latest advances in stem cell research appearing in the journal. We'll be speaking to authors to explore the questions that led to new breakthroughs and learn how they tackled those questions. We'll hear about the background to novel findings, the challenges ahead, and we'll get to know a little bit about the personalities behind the work. Thanks for listening in. Stem cell technology has led to remarkable insights into human biology and health and disease, and will hopefully one day produce cures for intractable medical conditions, including type 1 diabetes, Parkinson's disease, and many others. However, for the results and outputs from this research to be accurate, meaningful, and durable, it's essential that the field have agreed upon standards that ensure reproducibility and reliability of the data. Although such standards had been previously proposed for repositories and distribution centers, no widely accepted best practices exist for laboratory research within the human pluripotent and tissue stem cell fields. To fill that void, the International Society for Stem Cell Research has developed a set of recommendations, including reporting criteria for scientists in basic research laboratories. These criteria are designed to be technically and financially feasible to implement, and when implemented, to enhance the reproducibility and rigor of stem cell research. My guests on this episode of the podcast have been involved in many international efforts to develop standards and best practices around the use of pluripotent stem cells. They recently served as co-chairs of the ISSCR Standards Task Force that developed the document Standards for Human Stem Cell Research and Stem Cell Use and Research, which was released this past June. During our conversation, we'll discuss the need for standards, the challenges that the task force faced, and how this document will advance the field. I'm delighted to welcome two longtime colleagues, Dr. Tennille Ludwig and Professor Peter Andrews. Tennille Ludwig is a senior scientist and director of the Y-Cell Stem Cell Bank in Madison, Wisconsin. Tennille has been actively involved in numerous international efforts to improve the standards, characterization, and banking practice of pluripotent stem cells, and she holds leadership roles in the International Stem Cell Initiative and the International Stem Cell Banking Initiative. Currently, Tennille serves on the ISSCR's Manufacturing Clinical Translation and Industry Committee, and she co-chaired the ISSCR Standards Task Force. Peter Andrews is a professor emeritus at the University of Sheffield in the UK. A founder of the field of human pluripotency, Peter has had a distinguished career studying first embryonal carcinoma cells and then human embryonic stem cells. And he was the first to discover that human pluripotent stem cells could develop genetic abnormalities during long-term culture. He chaired the International Stem Cell Initiative, the first international effort to standardize methods for the characterization of human embryonic stem cells. And most recently, along with Tennille, he co-chaired the ISSCR Standards Task Force. Welcome to you both, and thanks for being here.
Thanks very much, Martin. It's great to be here.
Thank you, Martin.
So, Peter, you and I go way back. You're now an emeritus faculty member at Sheffield, which for our listeners reading between the lines means we've both been around a fairly long time. And in fact, you work on human embryonal carcinoma cells and their markers really laid a foundation for later work on embryonic stem cells. And, you know, it was really my first introduction to this field. So maybe, Peter, you could tell us a bit about the history of the early days of pluripotent stem cell research in the human and the transition you made from studying embryonal carcinoma cells.
Well, thanks very much, Martin, for that. It's a bit frightening to think back how far we've been playing in this field. My first introduction to embryonal carcinoma cells was in the mouse. As my first postdoc was at the Institut Pasteur in François Jacob's lab, and it was at a time in the early 70s when working on directly on mouse embryos, if you were interested in development, was tricky and difficult, and teratomas was seen as a possible interesting surrogate. And the other feature around at that time was an interest in the cell surface, I think probably stimulated by a lot of work in immunology, and a thought floating around that cell surface played a key role in development. And that led to particular interest in characterizing mouse embryonal carcinoma cells and surface antigen expression on them. I then moved to the Wistar Institute some 2 or 3 years later, and really joined Barbara Knowles and Darvill Salter. And this was after monoclonal antibodies had become the new tool on the block. And that gave us the possibility to develop new antibodies to define surface antigens on cells. And at the same time, while I joined their lab, we had the opportunity to work on a large number of human testicular cancer cell lines, which are essentially teratocarcinoma cell lines that have been derived from patients in a hospital in Minneapolis. And from there, I set about trying to characterize human EC cells. At this point, everyone had been working on mouse, and there was a sort of interest around, could we translate some of that interest to understanding human development? And also, these are significant clinical entities as well. So that led us to, first of all, trying to characterize human EC cells, and it was quite surprising that they're a bit different from the mouse. But eventually, we made a number of characteristics. We defined a number of surface antigen markers that were useful and characterized a pluripotent human EC cell line that would differentiate. That was NTERA2, and that kept us going for quite a long time. Now, Jamie Thompson was a PhD student with Darvill Salter in the lab at the time, and I got to know Jamie quite well. And subsequently, he moved on in his postdoc and then into a position at the Wisconsin Primate Center, where he had access to monkey embryos. And he was the first one to then derive monkey ES cells. And he was good in, and then a couple of years later, human ES cells. And he was good enough to let me know about that shortly before they were published, and offered to let us have the cell lines, which we obtained in Sheffield. And I set up our lab working with my PhD student, John Draper, at the time. And one of the early things that we found, we thought we'd found something really exciting, and almost by chance, happened to karyotype the cells just after we'd done that, discovering that they'd acquired an extra copy of chromosome 17. So we put that, I put that down to just bad luck, and we got out some more cells from the freezer, two different cell lines. They were karyotypically normal, and we tried to repeat our experiments. And then we karyotyped them again, and about 6 weeks later, they had also acquired an extra copy of chromosome 17, which said to us, there's something funny going on here. And we had some conversation with Jamie Thompson, who had been seeing gains of chromosome 12. And linking back to our earlier work on human EC cells, those are chromosome changes that are particularly common in those cancers. And we thought this was kind of an interesting observation. Maybe we were replicating cancer development. But it highlighted the whole issue of genetic variants in the cells, which kept us going as something else to work on later.
And an area that remains a challenge for the field, as the standards task force discussed at some length. Tennille, you haven't been around quite so long as Peter and I, but you've also made some very significant contributions to the field in your career. As a postdoctoral fellow in the Thompson Lab, you developed a feeder-free culture media for pluripotent stem cells that is now used all over the world. And now you're kind of the face of Y-Cell, a leading organization in the banking and use of pluripotent stem cells. Maybe you could tell us a bit about those early days in Wisconsin and Jamie's lab. And for, there'd be a lot of people who would be interested to know what attracted you to the role at Y-Cell, which is kind of a special role as against a conventional faculty academic career.
Yeah, early days in the Thompson Lab. Early days in the Thompson Lab were really the early days in the field. So I joined the Thompson Lab in 2001, which was just a couple of years after the initial development, was published. And so the work that was going on in the lab at the time was all really foundational, right? Everything, every advance was new and exciting. And these were the days where some of the work to early progenitors was done, but not to any sort of final lineages. So seeing all of that work start to be done and come through. The spirit in the lab was really kind of electric. Everybody was excited to be there. It was new, it was fresh, it was exciting, it was novel, and it had such amazing potential, which we are just now, 20 plus years later, seeing the fruits of. So, and you, working in that lab, you knew that, you knew what the potential was, you knew what you were working towards, and you knew that the work that you were doing had a real capacity to make a difference. The work that I did on the media, as part of the postdoc, and that's how I came to Jamie's lab. My background was all in embryology and developmental physiology, looking at media use by embryos. I was doing my PhD in Wisconsin at the time that Jamie published the work. And so the postdoc, moving to his lab as postdoc, wasn't something I ever thought would happen. I sent him a note asking him if he knew anybody else in the field who was looking, and he asked me to come in and talk to him. And the next thing I knew, I was in the lab. He happened to have a grant that was looking for someone to do some media development for serum-free, feeder-free media. And I said, I think I can do that. And 4 years later, we had it done. It was a big team effort. It was an accomplishment I'm still very proud of. It was about solving a problem for the community. As much as it was a really nice piece of research and a beautiful invention, it was about solving a problem that would move the community forward. And that's the piece of it that really sparks it for me, which is part of why the fit for me at Y-Cell is a good one. I had never been interested really in doing my own lab. My joy, while I love the academic research, there is nothing sexier than that moment when you are doing research and you come to an answer and you know, you've done your analysis and you have the answer and you know for that moment that you are the only one on the planet that knows what you know. There's something just kind of intellectually mind-blowing about that moment. And I've had a few of them and I love it. But what I love more is knowing that the work that I do pushes the field forward. And the work that I do is helping somebody else do the best that they can do in their work. And so Y-Cell for me was a more natural fit. I didn't have any interest in running my own lab. I never had. My background prior to going to college had all been in customer service. I like that. I like helping people. That's where I get my joy in the work that I do. And so working for an organization like Y-Cell, who has this nonprofit organization with a mission to serve this and support the stem cell community and stem cell technologies through the clinical trial, means I have the opportunity to work sort of an externally facing role and take on initiatives and projects that are meant to benefit the whole field and move the whole field forward, whether it's from providing good quality research materials to be involved in initiatives that generate international consensus to being able to participate in liaison meetings with the FDA and the EMA that will push regulations forward, or advocating in Congress for increased funding. I can be involved in those types of activities without restriction and be involved with things that will get the people in the field the resources, the information, the materials that they need to do the very best job that they can do. And that's what gives me joy in my work. That's why I work where I work.
That's terrific. And it's lucky for all of us that you found your pathway at a fairly early stage and stuck with it. So, you know, clearly you've both been very active in helping to try and bring standardization to the pluripotent stem cell field. And you've both been involved in some of the most important efforts around that goal, such as the International Stem Cell Initiative and the International Stem Cell Banking Initiative. So maybe we could hear these initiatives really laid the groundwork for this standards task force. So maybe we could hear a bit about them, how they got going, and what their goals were. Peter, first tell us about the ISCI International Stem Cell Initiative.
Yeah, so the ISCI really came about in the very early days after Jamie had published about the ES cells, and then other groups started around the world trying to do the same thing, and several other people published descriptions of human ES cell lines. I think a lot of the funding agencies in different countries became interested in what are we going to do with this, and there was the obvious issues of the ethical side of things, and at the same time the whole potential of where this could lead in human healthcare. And so as a result of that sort of interest, the Medical Research Council in the UK got together a meeting of, I've forgotten the number, something like 15 to 20 funding agencies from different countries around the world, held a meeting in London in 2003 to discuss really common interests between these funding agencies as to what they should be doing, how they could coordinate work, how they deal with the common problems that might arise. And each of the funding agencies brought along one or two of their scientists who were active in the field at that time, which was a pretty small field, in fact. And as a result of that, one of the things that people identified as an immediate concern were when people describe new human ES cell lines, were they the same thing? Were there any differences between them? And so out of that meeting, I was asked to form a steering committee, essentially to begin to address that question. And that the result of that was setting up the International Stem Cell Initiative. The funding agencies formed themselves into an organization called the International Stem Cell Forum. And they gave us, after we put together a research plan, they gave us a tranche of money to set up a project between different groups. And as a result, in the steering committee, we put together a plan. I mean, you were part of that steering committee, Martin, as were a number of other prominent people at the time. And so our first set of experiments was simply to try and coordinate all the labs who were working with human ES cells at the time and say, are they working on the same thing? What were the markers that they were using? What were the characteristics of these cells? And we set up the arrangement to distribute antibodies between the cell lines, and we set up an arrangement to collect RNA from the cells in culture so that they could be assessed for gene expression in a common lab. And we also set up to look at just were the cells sterile? Did they have any nasty things growing in them? And this was all done in conjunction with, at the same time, Jamie Thompson and Barbara Knowles set up a training course for human ES cells in Bar Harbor, the Jackson Laboratory. And so we coordinated with that and arranged a meeting of the ISCE project members in Bar Harbor in conjunction with that training course, which was really a really exciting opportunity for us all to meet and exchange ideas. And so that led anyway on to a series of meetings that we held mainly at the Jackson Laboratory, discussing various aspects. And eventually we published a report describing the various cell lines that had been worked on at that time. That was in 2007. And then that led on to further studies in which we've looked at culture media for the cells, looked at genetic variation in the cells in different labs around the world, and more recently, looking at methods for assessing pluripotency, taking advantage of the fact that we could bring together a large number of groups together and discuss and do things in a coordinated fashion. I have to say it was easier in those days because the number of people working in the field, we could get into a room and have a meeting of everyone. I think very much more difficult now when the field has exploded a lot. But hopefully that laid some of the foundations for some of the work going forward.
You know, those meetings, Peter, were some of, I was at, I think, all of them. And those meetings were some of my favorite memories from my career. when the field was small and intimate. Those meetings were very small and intimate. Peter had a way, for those who don't know, of trapping us all on an island that we couldn't get off of for 3 days and having us live in a together in a hotel that was a resort hotel that was shut down for the resort season. So we were together, being able to have collaborative conversations and discussions and really get to know each other well and spend 3 or 4 days strictly talking about the science and really set up an intimate community and an international consortium that was dedicated to making progress. And it was incredible. And Martin, your work with the training course at that point, I think you were leading the training aspect of it for a while with some help from Mary Firpo to get some of the initial scientists in the field trained up to help the technology spread globally. I think is a big hallmark of why the field was able to move as quickly as it has. So kudos to both of you for that initial work.
Well, before we go on to the banking initiative, I'll just add a couple of things to that. It's important to remember that back in the early 2000s, Nature and other journals were full of claims of pluripotent cells being isolated from brain, from bone marrow, from all sorts of tissues. And there really was a need to establish, what are the standards to assess pluripotency. The other thing is Peter had the remarkable skill with that funding, which was, I think, initially intended for 3 or 4 years of stretching it out over a couple decades. Which
Peter can pinch a penny, that's for sure.
Wonderful.
I think we kept it going for about 17 years. I did get some extra money out of people, and we did also had support from a number of companies who put in enough money to pay for lobster dinners at Bar Harbor as well.
So Tennille, the banking initiative has always been kind of closely related to ISCI. Tell us about how that got going.
Now, the banking initiative really is a sister organization to ISCI, and a lot of the members of the organizations overlap. The banking initiative started in about 2007, and it really is focused on the biobanking community and creating international consensus standards on the propagation, the crowd preservation, and the dissemination or distribution of materials from a biorepository standpoint. So for those groups that are supplying materials to the rest of the stem cell community, what is it we need to be aware of? What do we need to be doing? What sorts of testing needs to happen to ensure the safety of the materials as they're going out to researchers? And how do we, as a biobanking community, assure and promote, I don't know that you can't assure them, but promote those standards as new groups are coming online and starting to do this work in their own communities and countries?
So that leads nicely into our next question, and that's kind of brings us to the reason why you both are here today. That's the ISSCR's new document, Standards for Human Stem Cell Use and Research. Tennille, let's begin with the question. You've got a particular perspective on this of why are these standards needed?
Yeah, rigor and reproducibility has been sort of a hot topic for a little while recently. Even the NIH put into their grants that you needed to do indicate how you were going to promote rigor and reproducibility in your research. So we knew in general that it was an issue across the field. At YSL, we sort of have a unique opportunity to see what the ground state of the quality of materials is in the field at large. We take in materials from a variety of depositors from all over the planet for distribution. A lot of them are from federally funded or nationally funded projects that require distribution. So the materials come to us, and the materials that groups are sending us tend to be the lowest passage they have, what they believe to be their best material, what they are using in their own laboratories, and what they are sharing with collaborators. And what we find on testing them for just very basic quality aspects is that fully 35% of them fail basic quality testing. So the failures that they have would make them completely unreliable for getting valid data from in a research setting. When you think about that, that means that if you are obtaining cells from your neighbor down the hallway, you have a 1 in 3 chance that the material that you are getting, if you're not testing it yourself, is not appropriate to do research and will not provide you reliable, repeatable, valid results. In my mind, that's a pretty big crisis for the stem cell community, and it's something that needs to be addressed. And ISSCR stepped in to fill the gap. While ISSCE had done a great job of talking about what some of the initiatives are, while there are other groups that had discussed the need for standards and maybe promoted some of them, there was not any well-organized international consensus standard that was publicly available to the stem cell community. And with the kind of results that we were seeing with 35% failures that can affect the type of research that's coming out and being published, it's necessary to acknowledge it and address it and do what we can to help the field move forward from it.
Thank you. Peter, maybe you could give us a kind of broad overview of the standards document. You know, what areas does it tackle and why were these areas chosen?
So, as Tennille has sort of laid out the sort of starting point for this, and I think the other point of, there was a big driver was a perception that actually in many papers, when people describe their experiments, there's not a full description of what they've actually done to the extent of really allowing it to people to go about reproducing exactly those experiments again, which is an important part of doing the science. So we came up with 4 general areas for the recommendations. The first one was just general characterization of the cells and proving their provenance. And I think Tennille has touched on the reasons for that already. The second one was the issue of focusing on pluripotency. How were people defining pluripotent stem cell lines? In the very early days of human EC cells, when this whole issue was initiated, in a sense, people had to go to the lengths of actually cloning cell lines, showing that a clonal line was able to differentiate into all cell derivatives that were possible. And then as it became easier to obtain the cells, as more and more people began to come into the field, people tended to start taking shortcuts and assume that a cell, almost in some cases, that a cell coming from what would generally give rise to a pluripotent stem cell was indeed pluripotent. So really just so the second area was to make sure people understood how we define pluripotency and how they should be defined it in practice. And to also highlight the fact that, you know, the various markers and surrogates that we commonly use as convenient tools are not of themselves indicators that cells are pluripotent. And we cover quite a lot about the whole issue that so-called markers of stem cells are not necessarily markers of pluripotency. Pluripotency has to be defined by a functional assay showing the cells actually can differentiate. The third area that we tackled is the one we touched on a little earlier, is that of genetic variation, which has become a big issue in the field, because these cells clearly do acquire genetic variants over time, possibly because the variants give selective advantage, and they can give rise to these variants very quickly within a few passages. But we don't know the consequences of them. And at the same time, there's a lack of proper reporting of what variants have occurred in the cells that people are working with. Sometimes people don't report it at all. Other times people give very limited amounts of information. For example, they may show one karyotype and that's it. Whereas we know that if you do karyotyping, even if you do look at 20 metaphases, which is a common standard, you can miss cultures which have got even up to 20% of karyotypically abnormal cells in. So we wanted to encourage people to report on the variants they've got properly, at the same time recognizing that we really need to acquire information. So we don't want to stop people publishing results with cells that have genetic variants in, but we'd like to know what the variants are so that in the future we can begin to assess what the consequences and significances of those variants are. And then the last area we tackled was the issue of model systems and organoids, which is a new developing area where people are beginning to take advantage of the ability of embryonic pluripotent stem cells and their derivatives, or other stem cells derived from various tissues, to establish surrogates of tissues for in vitro modeling of disease processes and a drug action and so on. And as a new field, it's something that needs people to understand the constraints and what specific areas that they need to really take into account as they try and extract information from these new fields. So those were the four areas that we chose. And I think we had quite a vigorous discussion in all of them about how far we should go in asking people to report their results.
Come back to that shortly, but for right now, we're going to take a quick break. But when we return, we'll continue our discussion of standards in stem cell research.
Stem Cell Reports is ISSCR's open access, peer-reviewed society journal for scientists by scientists. The journal publishes research and commentaries that drive the field of stem cell science forward.
Welcome back to the Stem Cell Report. I've been talking with Tennille Ludwig and Peter Andrews about the development of standards for the use of human pluripotent and tissue stem cells, including the recently released ISSCR document, Standards for Human Stem Cell Use and Research. Tennille, among the many recommendations put forward in this document, are there some you think might be surprising to people in the general community? And kind of as a related question, how would you describe the overall level of awareness in our field of research standards that are particular to human stem cell research?
Honestly, I think in a lot of, particularly in the basic characterization sections and some of the genomic sections, I think people might be surprised by how unsurprising it is. I think a lot of the recommendations that are made in those areas are very understood to be important. It's just the implementation that has been lacking, and understanding, I think people know that it should be done, but understanding really the critical importance and how it affects your research is something that needs to be reinforced. There is sometimes some pushback on does this cost you too much money? And for the basic characterization, to do what we've asked to be done or what we've recommended will probably take 2 to 3 weeks and about $1,500, but it underpins the entire rest of your career in using those cells and establishes a level of quality that can be relied upon for future research. And in my mind, that's worth it. And I hope that it's obvious to others who read it, that's worth it. Maybe, honestly, I think some of the most surprising, based on where we are in the field right now, might be some of the work that Peter did in discussing really what pluripotency is and what it isn't. We tend to, at the moment in the community, talk about OCT4 and NANOG and things like that as being markers of pluripotency. And as Peter eloquently describes in the text, they're not. They're markers of the undifferentiated status, but they don't necessarily definitively define pluripotency. So that might be one of the more surprising things for some different groups. But other than that, I think part of the surprising thing about the document is that it's logical and readable and probably not all that surprising once you put it all in context.
So I guess that means you think that most people who are working in the area would be aware of these things. They just need a reminder.
For the basic characterization work, yes. For some of the pluripotency aspects, and for certainly the last section, section four, that has to do with organoids and model systems, and reminders on promoting transparency within the work, that the only way to really reliably reproduce work is to understand what was done in the first place. And so suggestions on how to report things so that they can be easily understood, fully understood and be able to be replicated is important.
I think one of the most important aspects of this document is disseminating the information so that it's preventative medicine, you know, so that we can drop your 30% reject rate down to about 5 or 10% maybe. So Peter, this standards document is very comprehensive. It deals with many important aspects of research. But if you had to give three pieces of advice about research practice to someone new coming into the field, let's say one of my neuroscience colleagues wants to start using stem cell models, what do you think the most important things for them to bear in mind are?
I think the first really touches back to what Tennille's been talking about. The first thing is really check the provenance of the cells that you've obtained. What information has been already collected about them? Where did they come from? What do we know about their genetic status? Do we know that they are actually the cells that you think they are? So if you get the cells from an established bank, they probably will have gone through a lot of checks. As Tennille said, if you go and get them from your colleague down the corridor, who knows? They may or may not have done it. So the first thing, I think, is really to check, what do you know about the cells you're getting? And I think a lot of us have had experiences in the past where we've actually been working with something that wasn't what we thought it was. So that's really crucial. I think the second thing is don't assume that the properties of the cells merely because they've been labeled stem cells or particularly pluripotent stem cells. Cells can have many features of pluripotent stem cells, but they can range from those that can fully differentiate into all somatic cell types through to cells which, as an oxymoron, are nullipotent stem cells. They have completely lost their ability to differentiate. And then there's a whole range of possibilities in between. So recognize that just because a cell is labeled a stem cell or a pluripotent stem cell, it doesn't tell you everything about what it can do. You need to know something about that individual cell line and whether it is appropriate for what you want to do. And I suppose the third important thing is to remember that these cells are living organisms and they change genetic because of how they've been grown, or because of epigenetic changes or genetic changes. These might be permanent or they might be transitory. But it's just worth remembering that the common genetic changes that do crop up in these cultures, they give a selective advantage to the cells. And it can very easily happen that you go from a culture of which you can't detect a genetic variant in to one in which all the cells carry a particular genetic variant within 3 or 4 weeks. They can take over very fast. So you need to be aware of that and monitor that continuously, because it may or may not have some significant effect on the results you're obtaining. So I guess those are the three key points that I would initially put to people. There may well be others.
Well, that would help keep people out of trouble for sure if they just stuck to those things. The standards task force process took some 18 months to complete. And being a part of it, I can say that during that time, there were a number of vigorous discussions, even amongst well-versed experts in the field. So I want to ask if we could recall, what are some of the more controversial, maybe not even controversial, complicated areas that came up for discussion? Peter, how do you see that?
Well, I think in the sense that a chunk of it related to the depth of the amount of information that we were suggesting people should report on. And there was a certain amount of pushback, and I think Tennille mentioned it, in terms of how much work was required to validate the provenance of the cells, or to particularly, for example, in relation to looking at the genetic status of the cells, when should this be done and at what depth? What sort of assays people should use? And I think there was a concern about overloading labs with too much potentially extraneous work, and whether this would, to some extent, detract from people taking up the recommendations. And I think in the end, what we were recognizing on the whole, some things we were pushing very strongly, other things we were pushing a bit less strongly. And we were recognizing this as really an aspirational document, that there's some things that definitely people really must do. But at the same time, we ended up saying, well, the final decisions are going to be left to the authors. These are the things they should take into account. These are the things that they should sort of think about doing. And these are how we suggest they do them. Of course, it's up to then subsequently to referees looking at papers to say whether they think the authors have done enough. But the key point in the end was to make sure that people reported what they've done. Even if they haven't done everything we wanted, at least tell us what you have done fully so that we can appreciate what's there and what's missing. I think that was the sort of key issue in the end.
Yeah, it's when you get an international group together. You're looking at differences in opinions from researcher to researcher, but you're also looking at differences in ability to conform to anything that we would write from national jurisdiction to national jurisdiction. So some of the discussions that we had that were more robust had to do with proposing something that literally couldn't be accomplished in a particular region because of legalities in there, and having to come to a compromise of being able to achieve the objective, but still respecting national limitations, particularly where genetics and disclosures and sharing of materials is concerned. So some of the most robust discussions that I recall had to do, as Peter said, with about when you're talking about doing the testing frequency, how frequently do you do it? I come from a biobanking background. What a biobank is going to do is certainly going to be more intense than what you would expect an average researcher in their laboratory to do. And some of our most robust discussions came around things like registries, which are reasonably new in the history of the field, but becoming more and more important because of the digital identity that a cell line carries with it. And partially because, as I see at Y-Cell, people have a tendency to name a cell line a very similar name, if not the exact name, of another cell line. So being able to distinguish cell lines within the literature becomes important, and registries can play a key point in that. So, but it may be challenging, particularly where adult tissues are concerned, because there isn't necessarily a registry for adult stem cells that can't be perpetually passaged. So understanding how best to accomplish the ability to maintain a digital identity to clarify the literature and develop a document that works for both pluripotent and adult stem cells was a discussion. I wouldn't say it was contentious, but it was certainly something we had to talk about for a while.
So. No, I think that last bit of the task force that dealt with organoids, tissue, stem cells, all those areas, was certainly one of the most challenging, and that's just because it's a new area, and I think still finding its way. But maybe we could turn to what I consider a very important part of this, and that's the implementation of these standards in the field. And so as editor-in-chief of Stem Cell Reports and a member of this committee, I've got a special interest in what we're calling the checklist, formerly known as the reporting practices for publishing results with human pluripotent and tissue stem cells. Tanil, tell us about the development of this document and its function.
The checklist is a really handy, very helpful document that we believe can help researchers, can help reviewers, can help editors. And it was really born out of initial conversations with editors. It was something that as we engaged the editorial community in the beginning of this process, they identified as something that would be helpful and necessary to be able to have a concise checklist that they would be able to provide to reviewers or authors to help as they were forming. And it would be something that would be simple, easy to read, easily understandable, but you could go back to the document for more information. So it really was sort of, you know, by the editorial community for the editorial community type of document, as we think that the bulk of the standards are, you know, from scientists for scientists. This is really from editors for editors in this. So we appreciate their engagement, their involvement. And the result of it is this checklist document.
Well, as you probably know, we're about to launch the experiment of using this checklist routinely in stem cell reports. It'll be fascinating to see the overall responses. I'm going to finish up today by talking about the two of you and your commitment to the field and the ISSCR Standards Task Force and your previous work and other international initiatives we've talked about. Just show you both been very active in service roles, if you will, in the research community. And these are incredibly important roles, but certainly they add additional responsibilities and time commitments beyond those of your own institutions. So, Tennille, you've spoken a bit about this. You've spoken about why this type of commitment is important, but I think for both of you, I'm going to ask you both, what advice would you give to young scientists, early career researchers, as they consider how to allocate their limited time between their own research pursuits and support of the research community as a whole? Tennille, I'll let you go first, then I'll ask Peter.
You know, the field is still very young. We're 20 years in, and in the state of different disciplines, this is still early days. Any involvement that you can have in larger consortia projects, dedicating time with the ISSCR or to any of the other initiatives that are out there, can genuinely help to shape the field for the better. So you have the opportunity to have a tremendous amount of impact with a minimal amount of time, quite frankly. You know, committee projects often take an hour or two a month. They don't have to be high. Some of them can be considerably more involved, but you have the opportunity to make a difference. Participating in things like Hill Days is one day a year where you have an opportunity for face-to-face with Congress to be able to explain in plain terms so that legislators who are making decisions understand the value of the research and have honest, truthful information about what the science is about. So these types of reasonably minimal commitments can make a tremendous difference in the field and really move it all forward. And I think it is probably one of the most valuable uses of your time. And beyond that, I think as a participant in a scientific community, it should be something you aim to do.
So it's important to give back.
It's necessary to give back. For those that are just coming up, you are benefiting from a lot of the work that people like Martin and Peter before us have invested in order to make what we are working in. They gave us the future that we are now existing in. We owe it to the next generation to assure that those types of opportunities and abilities continue to exist, and that takes effort.
Peter, how do you see this? What advice would you give to a young person along these lines?
I think for me, one of the most enjoyable and reasons that for doing science has been that it is actually an international group effort. And you know, over the years, I've met and worked with people from countries all around the world. We've been able to interact and develop ideas. And so, you know, your own research, it's easy to get tied up in your own project and just be look in the lab, go in every day and do what your ideas are. But being able to interact with other groups of people around the world and see what they're doing and have discussions with how they relate, what they think of what you're doing, what you think of they're doing, can really benefit your own research. as well as being great fun. And I think being involved in some of these big consortia that certainly I've done over the years has given me the opportunities to meet people on a level, social level, but is a social level that is actually constructive for taking research forward. I mean, I often think that the best part of going to a scientific meeting is not the formal talks, but actually them meeting people over a meal or a drink afterwards and discussing things. And that's where a lot of the big new ideas come from. And so being engaged in these sort of activities where we try to bring people together gives you that opportunity to interact with other people, both for the benefit of the group as a whole, the community as a whole, but also for your own benefit. So you obviously have to get on and do your own stuff, but you have to relate it to what everyone else is doing. And these meetings, such as the stem cell course that we ran in Bar Harbor for umpteen years in conjunction with the ISCE project, they were really instructive in taking the field forward. So people need to keep that in mind as they go around their own work.
Yeah, there's no question that the networking opportunities in being involved in some of these are absolutely phenomenal. And, you know, speaking of the time at ISCE, I spoke about that very fondly before. Some of the connections that I made, many of the connections that I made at those early ISCE meetings are still my closest collaborators and resources now in my career. So you create those bonds in that type of committee work and consensus consortium work that last a career, that are incredibly valuable.
No, I totally agree that experience of bringing people, you know, the pioneers in the field together at that stage, it was the first time many of us had talked and exchanged ideas. And it was really, really important, I think, in many ways. It's been great talking to you both. That's all we have time for today. Thank you for joining. Thank you to our guests for sharing their stories with us today. This has been the Stem Cell Report. Thanks to our audience for listening.
The International Society for Stem Cell Research is a global scientific society that promotes excellence in stem cell science and applications to human health. Our vision is a world where stem cell science is encouraged, ethics are prioritized, and discovery improves understanding and advances human health. To join us, visit www.isscr.org/membership.